always channel my emotions into my work. That way I don't hurt anyone but myself. I can't go through that again, I warn him. I know. I'll talk to them, says Cinna. Lunch makes me feel a bit better. Pheasant, with a selection of jewel-colored jellies, and tiny versions of real vegetables swimming in butter, and potatoes mashed with parsley. For dessert, we dip chunks of fruit in a pot of melted chocolate, and Cinna has to order a second pot, because I start just eating the stuff with a spoon. So, what are we wearing for the opening ceremonies? I finally ask as I scrape the second pot clean. Headlamps or fire? I know the chariot ride will require Peeta and me to be dressed in something coal-related. Something along that line, he says. When it's time to get in costume for the opening ceremonies, my prep team shows up, but Cinna sends them away, saying they've done such a spectacular job in the morning there's nothing left to do. They go off to recover, thankfully leaving me in Cinna's hands. He puts up my hair first, in the braided style my mother introduced him to, then proceeds with my makeup. Last year he used little so that the audience would recognize me when I landed in the arena. But now my face is almost obscured by the dramatic highlights and dark shadows. High arching eyebrows, sharp cheekbones, smoldering eyes, deep purple lips. The costume looks deceptively simple at first, just a fitted black jumpsuit that covers me from the neck down. He places a half crown, like the one I received as victor, on my head, but it's made of a heavy black metal, not gold. Then he adjusts the light in the room to mimic twilight and presses a button just inside the fabric on my wrist. I look down, fascinated, as my ensemble slowly comes to life, first with a soft golden light, but gradually transforming to the orange-red of burning coal. I look as if I have been coated in glowing embers. No, that I am a glowing ember straight from our fireplace. The colors rise and fall, shift and blend, in exactly the way the coals do. How did you do this? I say in wonder. Portia and I spent a lot of hours watching fires, says Cinna. Now, look at yourself. He turns me toward a mirror so that I can take in the entire effect. I do not see a girl, or even a woman, but some unearthly being who looks like she might make her home in the volcano that destroyed so many in Haymitch's Quell. The black crown, which now appears red-hot, casts strange shadows on my dramatically made-up face. Katniss, the girl on fire, has left behind her flickering flames and bejeweled gowns and soft candlelight frocks. She is as deadly as fire itself. I think this is just what I needed to face the others, I say. Yes, I think your days of pink lipstick and ribbons are behind you, says Cinna. He touches the button on my wrist again, extinguishing my light. Let's not run down your power pack. When you're on the chariot this time, no waving, no smiling. I just want you to look straight ahead as if the entire audience is beneath your notice. Finally, something I'll be good at, I say. Cinna has a few more things to attend to, so I decide to head down to the ground floor of the Remake Center, which houses the huge gathering place for the tributes and their chariots before the opening ceremonies. I'm hoping to find Peeta and Haymitch, but they haven't arrived yet. Unlike last year, when all the tributes were practically glued to their chariots, the scene is very social. The victors, both this year's tributes and their mentors, are standing around in small groups, talking. Of course, they all know one another, and I don't know anyone, and I'm not really the sort of person to go around introducing myself. So I just stroke the neck of one of my horses and try not to be noticed. It doesn't work. The crunching hits my ear before I even know he's beside me, and when I turn my head, Finnick O'Dare's famous sea-green eyes are only inches from mine. He pops a sugar cube in his mouth and leans against my horse. "Hello, Katniss," he says, as if we've known each other for years, when in fact we've never met. "Hello, Finnick," I say, just as casually, although I'm feeling uncomfortable at his closeness, especially since he's got so much bare skin exposed.
"Want a sugar cube?"
he says, offering his hand, which is piled high.
"They're supposed to be for the horses, but who cares? They've got years to eat sugar, whereas you and I, well, if we see something sweet, we better grab it quick."
Finnick O'Dare is something of a living legend in Panem. Since he won the 65th Hunger Games when he was only 14, he's still one of the youngest victors. Being from District 4, he was a career, so the odds were already in his favor. But what no trainer could claim to have given him was his extraordinary beauty. Tall, athletic, with golden skin and bronze-colored hair, and those incredible eyes. While other tributes that year were hard-pressed to get a handful of grain or some matches for a gift, Finnick never wanted for anything, not food or medicine or weapons. It took about a week for his competitors to realize that he was the one to kill, but it was too late. He was already a good fighter with the spears and knives he had found in the cornucopia. When he received a silver parachute with a trident, which may be the most expensive gift I've ever seen given in the arena, it was all over. District 4's industry is fishing. He'd been on boats his whole life. The trident was a natural, deadly extension of his arm. He wove a net out of some kind of vine he found, used it to entangle his opponents so he could spear them with the trident, and within a matter of days the crown was his. The citizens of the capital have been drooling over him ever since. Because of his youth, they couldn't really touch him for the first year or two, but ever since he turned 16, he spent his time at the games being dogged by those desperately in love with him. No one retains his favor for long. He can go through 4 or 5 in his annual visit. Old or young, lovely or plain, rich or very rich, he'll keep them company and take their extravagant gifts, but he never stays, and once he's gone, he never comes back. I can't argue that Finnick isn't one of the most stunning, sensuous people on the planet, but I can honestly say he's never been attractive to me. Maybe he's too pretty, or maybe he's too easy to get, or maybe it's really that he'd just be too easy to lose. "No thanks," I say to the sugar. "I'd love to borrow your outfit sometime, though." He's draped in a golden net that's strategically knotted at his groin so that he can't technically be called naked, but he's about as close as you can get. I'm sure his stylist thinks the more of Finnick the audience sees, the better.
"You're absolutely terrifying me in that getup. What happened to the pretty little girl dresses?" he asks.
He wets his lips just ever so slightly with his tongue. Probably this drives most people crazy, but for some reason all I can think of is old Cray salivating over some poor starving young woman. "I outgrew them," I say. Finnick takes the collar of my outfit and runs it between his fingers.
"It's too bad about this Quell thing. You could have made out like a bandit in the capital. Jewels, money, anything you wanted."
"I don't like jewels, and I have more money than I need. What do you spend all yours on anyway, Finnick?" I say.
"Oh, I haven't dealt in anything as common as money for years," says Finnick.
"Then how do they pay you for the pleasure of your company?" I ask.
"With secrets," he says softly.
He tips his head in so his lips are almost in contact with mine.
"What about you, girl on fire? Do you have any secrets worth my time?"
For some stupid reason, I blush, but I force myself to hold my ground.
No, I'm an open book, I whisper back. Everybody seems to know my secrets before I know them myself.
He smiles. Unfortunately, I think that's true. His eyes flicker off to the side. PETA is coming. Sorry you have to cancel your wedding. I know how devastating that must be for you.
He tosses another sugar cube in his mouth and saunters off. PETA's beside me, dressed in an outfit identical to mine.
What did Finnick O'Dare want? He asks.
I turn and put my lips close to PETA's and drop my eyelids in imitation of Finnick. He offered me sugar and wanted to know all my secrets, I say in my best seductive voice.
PETA laughs. Ugh! Not really.
Really, I say. I'll tell you more when my skin stops crawling.
Do you think we'd have ended up like this if only one of us had won? He asks, glancing around at the other victors. Just another part of the freak show?
Sure, especially you, I say.
Oh, and why especially me? He says with a smile.
Because you have a weakness for beautiful things and I don't, I say with an air of superiority. They would lure you into their capital ways and you'd be lost entirely.
Having an eye for beauty isn't the same thing as a weakness, PETA points out, except possibly when it comes to you.
The music is beginning and I see the wide doors opening for the first chariot, hear the roar of the crowd.
Shall we?
He holds out a hand to help me into the chariot. I climb up and pull him up after me. Hold still, I say, and straighten his crown. Have you seen your suit turned on? We're going to be fabulous again.
Absolutely, but Portia says we're to be very above it all. No waving or anything, he says. Where are they, anyway?
I don't know. I eye the procession of chariots. Maybe we better go ahead and switch ourselves on.
We do, and as we begin to glow, I can see people pointing at us and chattering, and I know that, once again, we'll be the talk of the opening ceremonies.
We're almost at the door. I crane my head around, but neither Portia nor Cinna, who were with us right up to the final second last year, are anywhere in sight. Are we supposed to hold hands this year? I ask.
I guess they've left it up to us, says PETA.
I look up into those blue eyes that no amount of dramatic makeup can make truly deadly, and remember how, just a year ago, I was prepared to kill him, convinced he was trying to kill me. Now everything is reversed. I'm determined to keep him alive, knowing the cost will be my own life. But the part of me that is not so brave as I could wish is glad that it's PETA, not Haymitch, beside me. Our hands find each other without further discussion. Of course, we will go into this as one. The voice of the crowd rises into one universal scream as we roll into the fading evening light, but neither one of us reacts. I simply fix my eyes on a point far in the distance and pretend there is no audience, no hysteria. I can't help catching glimpses of us on the huge screens along the route, and we are not just beautiful, we are dark and powerful. No more, we star-crossed lovers from District 12, who suffered so much and enjoyed so little the rewards of our victory, do not seek the fans' favor. Grace them with our smiles, or catch their kisses. We are unforgiving. And I love it. Getting to be myself at last. As we curve around into the loop of the city circle, I can see that a couple of other stylists have tried to steal Cinna and Portia's idea of illuminating their tributes. The electric light-studded outfits from District 3, where they make electronics, at least make sense. But what are the livestock keepers from District 10, who are dressed as cows, doing with flaming belts? Broiling themselves? Pathetic. PETA and I, on the other hand, are so mesmerizing with our ever-changing coal costume that most of the other tributes are staring at us. We seem particularly riveting to the pair from District 6, who are known morphling addicts, both bone-thin, with sagging yellowish skin. They can't tear their overlarge eyes away, even when President Snow begins to speak from his balcony, welcoming us all to the Quell. The anthem plays, and as we make our final trip around the circle, am I wrong? Or do I see the President fixated on me as well? Peter and I wait until the doors of the training center have closed behind us to relax. Cinna and Portia are there, pleased with our performance, and Haymitch has made an appearance this year as well, only he's not at our chariot. He's over with the tributes of District 11. I see him nod in our direction, and then they follow him over to greet us. I know Chaff by sight, because I've spent years watching him pass a bottle back and forth with Haymitch on television. He's dark-skinned, about 6 feet tall, and one of his arms ends in a stump because he lost his hand in the games he won 30 years ago. I'm sure they offered him some artificial replacement, like they did Peeta when they had to amputate his lower leg, but I guess he didn't take it. The woman, Cedar, looks almost like she could be from the seam, with her olive skin and straight black hair streaked with silver. Only her golden brown eyes mark her as from another district. She must be around 60, but she still looks strong, and there's no sign she's turned to liquor or morphling or any other chemical form of escape over the years. Before either of us says a word, she embraces me. I know somehow it must be because of Rue and Thresh. Before I can stop myself, I whisper, "The families? They're alive," she says back softly before letting me go. Chaff throws his good arm around me and gives me a big kiss right on the mouth. I jerk back, startled, while he and Haymitch guffaw. That's about all the time we get before the Capitol attendants are firmly directing us toward the elevators. I get the distinct feeling they're not comfortable with the camaraderie among the victors, who couldn't seem to care less. As I walk toward the elevators, my hand still linked with Peeta's, someone else rustles up to my side. The girl pulls off a headdress of leafy branches and tosses it behind her without bothering to look where it falls. Joanna Mason, from District 7, Lumber and Paper, thus the tree. She won by very convincingly portraying herself as weak and helpless so that she would be ignored. Then she demonstrated a wicked ability to murder. She ruffles up her spiky hair and rolls her wide-set brown eyes. "Isn't my costume awful? My stylist's the biggest idiot in the Capitol. Our tributes have been trees for 40 years under her. Wish I'd gotten Cinna. You look fantastic." Girl talk. That thing I've always been so bad at. Opinions on clothes, hair, makeup. So I lie. "Yeah, he's been helping me design my own clothing line. You should see what he can do with velvet." Velvet? The only fabric I could think of off the top of my head. "I have. On your tour, that strapless number you wore in District 2, the deep blue one with the diamonds, so gorgeous I wanted to reach through the screen and tear it right off your back," says Joanna. "I bet you did," I think, "with a few inches of my flesh." While we wait for the elevators, Joanna unzips the rest of her tree, letting it drop to the floor, and then kicks it away in disgust. Except for her forest green slippers, she doesn't have a stitch of clothing. "That's better." We end up on the same elevator with her, and she spends the whole ride to the 7th floor chatting to Peeta about his paintings while the light of his still glowing costume reflects off her bare breasts. When she leaves, I ignore him, but I just know he's grinning. I toss aside his hand as the doors close behind Chaff and Cedar, leaving us alone. And he breaks out laughing. "What?" I say, turning on him as we step out on our floor. "It's you, Katniss," Can't you see? He says. What's me? I say. Why they're all acting like this? Finnick with his sugar cubes and Chaff kissing you and that whole thing with Joanna stripping down? He tries to take a more serious tone, unsuccessfully. They're playing with you because you're so... you know. No, I don't know, I say, and I really have no idea what he's talking about. It's like when you wouldn't look at me naked in the arena, even though I was half dead. You're so... pure, he says finally. I am not, I say. I've been practically ripping your clothes off every time there's been a camera for the last year. Yeah, but, I mean, for the capital, you're pure, he says, clearly trying to mollify me. For me, you're perfect. They're just teasing you. No, they're laughing at me, and so are you, I say. No, Peter shakes his head, but he's still suppressing a smile. I'm seriously rethinking the question of who should get out of these games alive when the other elevator opens. Haymitch and Effie join us, looking pleased about something. Then Haymitch's face grows hard. What did I do now? I almost say, but I see he's staring behind me at the entrance to the dining room. Effie blinks in the same direction, then says brightly, Looks like they've got you a matched set this year. I turn around and find the red-headed Avox girl who tended to me last year until the games began. I think how nice it is to have a friend here. I notice that the young man beside her, another Avox, also has red hair. That must be what Effie meant by a matched set. Then a chill runs through me. Because I know him, too. Not from the capital, but from years of having easy conversations at the hob, joking over greasy Say's soup, and that last day, watching him lie unconscious in the square while the life bled out of Gale. Our new Avox is Darius. Chapter 16 Haymitch grips my wrist as if anticipating my next move, but I am as speechless as the capital's torturers have rendered Darius. Haymitch once told me they did something to Avox's tongues so they could never talk again. In my head, I hear Darius's voice, playful and bright, ringing across the hob to tease me. Not as my fellow victors make fun of me now, but because we genuinely liked each other. If Gale could see him, I know any move I would make toward Darius, any act of recognition, would only result in punishment for him, so we just stare into each other's eyes. Darius, now a mute slave, me, now headed to death. What would we say, anyway? That we're sorry for the other's lot? That we ache for the other's pain? That we're glad we had the chance to know each other? No, Darius shouldn't be glad he knew me. If I had been there to stop Thread, he wouldn't have stepped forward to save Gale, wouldn't be an Avox, and more specifically, wouldn't be my Avox, because President Snow has so obviously had him placed here for my benefit. I twist my wrist from Haymitch's grasp, and head down to my old bedroom, locking the door behind me. I sit on the side of my bed, elbows on my knees, forehead on my fists, and watch my glowing suit in the darkness, imagining I am in my old home in District 12, huddled beside the fire. It slowly fades back to black as the power pack dies out. When Effie eventually knocks on the door to summon me to dinner, I get up and take off my suit, fold it neatly, and set it on the table with my crown. In the bathroom, I wash the dark streaks of makeup from my face. I dress in a simple shirt and pants and go down the hall to the dining room. I'm not aware of much at dinner except that Darius and the red-headed Avox girl are our servers. Effie, Hamish, Cinna, Portia, and Peeta are all there, talking about the opening ceremonies, I suppose. But the only time I really feel present is when I purposely knock a dish of peas on the floor, and before anyone can stop me, crouch down to clean them up. Darius is right by me when I send the dish over, and we two are briefly side by side, obscured from view as we scoop up the peas. For just one moment our hands meet. I can feel his skin, rough under the buttery sauce from the dish. In the tight, desperate clench of our fingers are all the words we will never be able to say. Then Effie's clucking at me from behind about how that's not your job, Katniss, and he lets go. When we go in to watch the recap of the opening ceremonies, I wedge myself in between Cinna and Haymitch on the couch because I don't want to be next to Peeta. This awfulness with Darius belongs to me and Gale, and maybe even Haymitch, but not to Peeta. He might have known Darius to nod hello, but Peeta wasn't Hob the way the rest of us were. Besides, I'm still angry with him for laughing at me along with the other victors, and the last thing I want is his sympathy and comfort. I haven't changed my mind about saving him in the arena, but I don't owe him more than that. As I watch the procession to the city circle, I think how it's bad enough that they dress us all in costumes and parade us through the streets in chariots on a regular year. Kids in costumes are silly, but aging victors, it turns out, are pitiful. A few who are on the younger side, like Joanna and Finnick, or whose bodies haven't fallen into disrepair, like Cedar and Brutus, can still manage to maintain a little dignity. But the majority, who are in the clutches of drink, or morphling, or illness, look grotesque in their costumes, depicting cows and trees and loaves of bread. Last year we chattered away about each contestant, but tonight there's only the occasional comment. Small wonder the crowd goes wild when Peeta and I appear, looking so young and strong and beautiful in our brilliant costumes. The very image of what tributes should be. As soon as it's over, I stand up and thank Cinna and Portia for their amazing work and head off to bed. Effie calls a reminder to meet early for breakfast to work out our training strategy, but even her voice sounds hollow. Poor Effie. She finally had a decent year in the games with Peeta and me, and now it's all broken down into a mess that even she can't put a positive spin on. In capital terms, I'm guessing this counts as a true tragedy. Soon after I go to bed, there's a quiet knock on my door, but I ignore it. I don't want Peeta tonight, especially not with Darius around. It's almost as bad as if Gale were here. Gale, how am I supposed to let him go with Darius haunting the hallways? Tongues figure prominently in my nightmares. First, I watch frozen and helpless while gloved hands carry out the bloody dissection in Darius's mouth. Then, I'm at a party where everyone wears masks and someone with a flickering wet tongue, who I suppose is Finnick, stalks me. But when he catches me and pulls off his mask, it's President Snow, and his puffy lips are dripping in bloody saliva. Finally, I'm back in the arena, my own tongue as dry as sandpaper, while I try to reach a pool of water that recedes every time I'm about to touch it. When I wake, I stumble to the bathroom and gulp water from the faucet until I can hold no more. I strip off my sweaty clothes and fall back into bed, naked, and somehow find sleep again. I delay going down to breakfast as long as possible the next morning, because I really don't want to discuss our training strategy. What's to discuss? Every victor already knows what everybody else can do, or used to be able to do anyway. So Peeta and I will continue to act in love, and that's that. Somehow, I'm just not up to talking about it, especially with Darius standing mutely by. I take a long shower, dress slowly in the outfit Cinna has left for training, and order food from the menu in my room by speaking into a mouthpiece. In a minute, sausage, eggs, potatoes, bread, juice, and hot chocolate appear. I eat my fill, trying to drag out the minutes until 10 o'clock, when we have to go down to the training center. By 9:30, Haymitch is pounding on my door, obviously fed up with me, ordering me to the dining room now. Still, I brush my teeth before meandering down the hall, effectively killing another 5 minutes. The dining room's empty, except for Peeta and Haymitch, whose face is flushed with drink and anger. On his wrist he wears a solid gold bangle with a pattern of flames. This must be his concession to Effie's matching token plan, that he twists unhappily. It's a very handsome bangle, really, but the movement makes it seem like something confining, a shackle, rather than a piece of jewelry.
"You're late," he snarls at me.
"Sorry. I slept in after the mutilated tongue nightmares kept me up half the night." I mean to sound hostile, but my voice catches at the end of the sentence. Haymitch gives me a scowl, then relents.
"All right, never mind. Today, in training, you've got 2 jobs. One, stay in love."
"Obviously," I say.
"And 2, make some friends," says Haymitch.
"No," I say. "I don't trust any of them. I can't stand most of them, and I'd rather operate with just the 2 of us.
"That's what I said at first, but," Peeta begins. "But it won't be enough," Haymitch insists. "You're going to need more allies this time around."
"Why?" I ask.
"Because you're at a distinct disadvantage. Your competitors have known each other for years. So who do you think they're going to target first?" he says.
"Us. And nothing we're going to do is going to override any old friendship," I say. "So why bother?"
"Because you can fight. You're popular with the crowd. That could still make you desirable allies. But only if you let the others know you're willing to team up with them," says Haymitch.
"You mean you want us in the career pack this year?" I ask, unable to hide my distaste. Traditionally, the tributes from District 1, 2, and 4 join forces, possibly taking in a few other exceptional fighters and hunt down the weaker competitors.
"That's been our strategy, hasn't it? To train like careers?" counters Haymitch. "And who makes up the career pack is generally agreed upon before the games begin. Peeta barely got in with them last year."
I think of the loathing I felt when I discovered Peeta was with the careers during the last games. "So we're to try to get in with Finnick and Brutus. Is that what you're saying?"
"Not necessarily. Everyone's a victor. Make your own pack if you'd rather. Choose who you like. I'd suggest Chaff and Cedar. Although Finnick's not to be ignored," says Haymitch. "Find someone to team up with who might be of some use to you. Remember, you're not in a ring full of trembling children anymore. These people are all experienced killers, no matter what shape they appear to be in."
Maybe he's right. Only who could I trust? Cedar, maybe. But do I really want to make a pact with her, only to possibly have to kill her later? No. Still, I made a pact with Rue under the same circumstances. I tell Haymitch I'll try, even though I think I'll be pretty bad at the whole thing. Effie shows up a bit early to take us down, because last year, even though we were on time, we were the last 2 tributes to show up. But Haymitch tells her he doesn't want her taking us down to the gym. None of the other victors will be showing up with a babysitter, and being the youngest, it's even more important we look self-reliant. So she has to satisfy herself with taking us to the elevator, fussing over our hair, and pushing the button for us. It's such a short ride that there's no real time for conversation, but when Peeta takes my hand, I don't pull it away. I may have ignored him last night in private, but in training we must appear as an inseparable team. Effie needn't have worried about us being the last to arrive. Only Brutus and the woman from District 2, Enobaria, are present. Enobaria looks to be about 30, and all I can remember about her is that in hand-to-hand combat, she killed one tribute by ripping open his throat with her teeth. She became so famous for this act that after she was a victor, she had her teeth cosmetically altered so each one ends in a sharp point like a fang and is inlaid with gold. She has no shortage of admirers in the capital. By 10 o'clock, only about half of the tributes have shown up. Atala, the woman who runs training, begins her spiel right on time, unfazed by the poor attendance. Maybe she expected it. I'm sort of relieved, because that means there are a dozen people I don't have to pretend to make friends with. Atala runs through the list of stations, which include both combat and survival skills, and releases us to train. I tell Peeta I think we'd do best to split up, thus covering more territory. When he goes off to chuck spears with Brutus and Chaff, I head over to the knot-tying station. Hardly anyone ever bothers to visit it. I like the trainer, and he remembers me fondly, maybe because I spent time with him last year. He's pleased when I show him I can still set the trap that leaves an enemy dangling by a leg from a tree. Clearly he took note of my snares in the arena last year, and now sees me as an advanced pupil. So I ask him to review every kind of knot that might come in handy, and a few that I'll probably never use. I'd be content to spend the morning alone with him, but after about an hour and a half, someone puts his arm around me from behind, his fingers easily finishing the complicated knot I've been sweating over. Of course, it's Finnick, who seems to have spent his childhood doing nothing but wielding tridents and manipulating ropes into fancy knots for nets, I guess. I watch for a minute while he picks up a length of rope, makes a noose, and then pretends to hang himself for my amusement. Rolling my eyes, I head over to another vacant station where tributes can learn to build fires. I already make excellent fires, but I'm still pretty dependent on matches for starting them. So the trainer has me work with flint, steel, and some charred cloth. This is much harder than it looks, and even working as intently as I can, it takes me about an hour to get a fire going. I look up with a triumphant smile, only to find I have company. The two tributes from District 3 are beside me, struggling to start a decent fire with matches. I think about leaving, but I really want to try using the flint again, and if I have to report back to Haymitch that I tried to make friends, these two might be a bearable choice. Both are small in stature, with ashen skin and black hair. The woman, Wyrus, is probably around my mother's age and speaks in a quiet, intelligent voice. But right away I notice she has a habit of dropping off her words in mid-sentence, as if she's forgotten you're there. Beatty, the man, is older and somewhat fidgety. He wears glasses but spends a lot of time looking under them. They're a little strange, but I'm pretty sure neither of them is going to try to make me uncomfortable by stripping naked. And they're from District 3. Maybe they can even confirm my suspicions of an uprising there. I glance around the training center. Peeta is at the center of a ribald circle of knife throwers. The Morphlings from District 6 are in the camouflage station, painting each other's faces with bright pink swirls. The male tribute from District 5 is vomiting wine on the sword-fighting floor. Finnick and the old woman from his district are using the archery station. Joanna Mason is naked again and oiling her skin down for a wrestling lesson. I decide to stay put. Wyrus and Beatty make decent company. They seem friendly enough, but don't pry. We talk about our talents. They tell me they both invent things, which makes my supposed interest in fashion seem pretty weak. Wyrus brings up some sort of stitching device she's working on.
It senses the density of the fabric and selects the strength, she says,
and then becomes absorbed in a bit of dry straw before she can go on.
The strength of the thread,
Beatty finishes explaining. Automatically, it rules out human error. Then he talks about his recent success creating a musical chip that's tiny enough to be concealed in a flake of glitter but can hold hours of songs. I remember Octavia talking about this during the wedding shoot, and I see a possible chance to allude to the uprising. Oh, yeah. My prep team was all upset a few months ago, I think, because they couldn't get hold of that, I say casually. I guess a lot of orders from District 3 were getting backed up. Beatty examines me under his glasses. Yes. Did you have any similar backups in coal production this year? He asks. No. Well, we lost a couple of weeks when they brought in a new head peacekeeper and his crew, but nothing major, I say. To production, I mean. 2 weeks sitting around your house doing nothing just means 2 weeks of being hungry for most people. I think they understand what I'm trying to say, that we've had no uprising.
Oh, that's a shame, says Wyrus in a slightly disappointed voice.
I found your district very... She trails off, distracted by something in her head. Interesting, fills in Beatty. We both did. I feel bad, knowing that their district must have suffered much worse than ours. I feel I have to defend my people. Well, there aren't very many of us in 12, I say. Not that you'd know it nowadays by the size of the peacekeeping force, but I guess we're interesting enough. As we move over to the shelter station, Wyra stops and gazes up at the stands where the game makers are roaming around, eating and drinking, sometimes taking notice of us.
Look,
she says, giving her head a slight nod in their direction. I look up and see Plutarch Heavensby in the magnificent purple robe with the fur-trimmed collar that designates him as head game maker. He's eating a turkey leg. I don't see why this merits comment, but I say, yes, he's been promoted to head game maker this year.
No, no. There, by the corner of the table. You can just,
says Wyrus. Beatty squints under his glasses.
Just make it out.
I stare in that direction, perplexed. But then I see it. A patch of space about 6 inches square at the corner of the table seems almost to be vibrating. It's as if the air is rippling in tiny, visible waves, distorting the sharp edges of the wood and a goblet of wine someone has set there.
A force field. They've set one up between the game makers and us. I wonder what brought that on,
Beatty says. Me, probably, I confess. Last year I shot an arrow at them during my private training session. Beatty and Wyrus look at me curiously. I was provoked. So, do all force fields have a spot like that?
Chink,
says Wyrus vaguely. In the armor, as it were, finishes Beatty. Ideally, it'd be invisible, wouldn't it? I want to ask them more, but lunch is announced. I look for Peeta, but he's hanging with a group of about 10 other victors, so I decide just to eat with District 3. Maybe I can get Cedar to join us. When we make our way into the dining area, I see some of Peeta's gang have other ideas. They're dragging all the smaller tables to form one large table so that we all have to eat together. Now I don't know what to do. Even at school, I used to avoid eating at a crowded table. Frankly, I'd probably have sat alone if Madge hadn't made it a habit of joining me. I guess I'd have eaten with Gale, except, being 2 grades apart, our lunch never fell at the same time. I take a tray and start making my way around the food-laden carts that ring the room. Peeta catches up with me at the stew.
How's it going?
Good. Fine. I like the District 3 victors, I say. Wyrus and Beatty.
Really?
He asks.
There's something of a joke to the others.
Why does that not surprise me? I say. I think of how Peter was always surrounded at school by a crowd of friends. It's amazing, really, that he ever took any notice of me except to think I was odd.
Joanna's nicknamed them Nuts and Volts, he says. I think she's nuts and he's volts.
And so I'm stupid for thinking they might be useful because of something Joanna Mason said while she was oiling up her breasts for wrestling, I retort.
Actually, I think the nickname's been around for years, and I didn't mean that as an insult. I'm just sharing information, he says.
Well, Wyrus and Beatty are smart. They invent things. They could tell by sight that a force field had been put up between us and the game makers, and if we have to have allies, I want them.
I toss the ladle back in a pot of stew, splattering us both with gravy.
What are you so angry about? Peter asks, wiping the gravy from his shirt front. Because I teased you on the elevator?
I'm sorry. I thought you would just laugh about it.
Forget it, I say with a shake of my head. It's a lot of things.
Darius, he says.
Darius, the games, Haymitch making us team up with the others, I say.
It can just be you and me, you know, he says.
I know, but maybe Haymitch is right, I say. Don't tell him I said so, but he usually is where the games are concerned.
Well, you can have final say about our allies, but right now I'm leaning toward Chaff and Cedar, says Peeta.
I'm okay with Cedar, not Chaff, I say. Not yet, anyway.
Come on and eat with him. I promise I won't let him kiss you again, says Peeta.
Chaff doesn't seem as bad at lunch. He's sober, and while he talks too loud and makes bad jokes a lot, most of them are at his own expense. I can see why he would be good for Haymitch, whose thoughts run so darkly. But I'm still not sure I'm ready to team up with him. I try hard to be more sociable, not just with Chaff, but with the group at large. After lunch, I do the edible insect station with the District 8 tributes. Cecilia, who's got 3 kids at home, and Woof, a really old guy who's hard of hearing and doesn't seem to know what's going on since he keeps trying to stuff poisonous bugs in his mouth. I wish I could mention meeting Twill and Bonnie in the woods, but I can't figure out how. Cashmere and Gloss, the sister and brother from District 1, invite me over, and we make hammocks for a while. They're polite but cool, and I spend the whole time thinking about how I killed both the tributes from their district, Glimmer and Marvel, last year, and that they probably knew them and might even have been their mentors. Both my hammock and my attempt to connect with them are mediocre at best. I join Inobaria at sword training and exchange a few comments, but it's clear neither of us wants to team up. Finnick appears again when I'm picking up fishing tips, but mostly just to introduce me to Mags, the elderly woman who's also from District 4. Between her district accent and her garbled speech, possibly she had a stroke, I can't make out more than 1 in 4 words, but I swear she can make a decent fishhook out of anything. A thorn, a wishbone, an earring. After a while, I tune out the trainer and simply try to copy whatever Mags does. When I make a pretty good hook out of a bent nail and fasten it to some strands of my hair, she gives me a toothless smile and an unintelligible comment I think might be praise. Suddenly, I remember how she volunteered to replace the young hysterical woman in her district. It couldn't be because she thought she had any chance of winning. She did it to save the girl, just like I volunteered last year to save Prim. And I decide I want her on my team.
Great. Now I have to go back and tell Haymitch I want an 80-year-old and Nuts and Volts for my allies. He'll love that. So I give up trying to make friends and go over to the archery range for some sanity. It's wonderful there, getting to try out all the different bows and arrows.
The trainer, Tax, seeing that the standing targets offer no challenge for me, begins to launch these silly fake birds high into the air for me to hit. At first it seems stupid, but it turns out to be kind of fun. Much more like hunting a moving creature. Since I'm hitting everything he throws up, he starts increasing the number of birds he sends airborne. I forget the rest of the gym and the victors and how miserable I am and lose myself in the shooting. When I manage to take down 5 birds in 1 round, I realize it's so quiet I can hear each one hit the floor. I turn and see the majority of the victors have stopped to watch me. Their faces show everything from envy to hatred to admiration. After training, Peter and I hang out, waiting for Haymitch and Effie to show up for dinner. When we're called to eat, Haymitch pounces on me immediately. "So at least half the victors have instructed their mentors to request you as an ally. I know it can't be your sunny personality." "They saw her shoot," says Peter with a smile. "Actually, I saw her shoot, for real, for the first time. I'm about to put in a formal request myself."
"You're that good?" Haymitch asks me. "So good that Brutus wants you?"
I shrug. "But I don't want Brutus. I want Mags and District 3.
"Of course you do," Haymitch sighs and orders a bottle of wine. "I'll tell everybody you're still making up your mind."
After my shooting exhibition, I still get teased some, but I no longer feel like I'm being mocked. In fact, I feel as if I've somehow been initiated into the victor's circle. During the next 2 days, I spend time with almost everybody headed for the arena. Even the morphlings, who, with Peeta's help, paint me into a field of yellow flowers. Even Finnick, who gives me an hour of trident lessons in exchange for an hour of archery instruction. And the more I come to know these people, the worse it is. Because on the whole, I don't hate them, and some I like. And a lot of them are so damaged that my natural instinct would be to protect them. But all of them must die if I am to save Peter. The final day of training ends with our private sessions. We each get 15 minutes before the game makers to amaze them with our skills, but I don't know what any of us might have to show them. There's a lot of kidding about it at lunch, what we might do, sing, dance, strip, tell jokes. Mags, who I can understand a little better now, decides she's going to take a nap. I don't know what I'm going to do. Shoot some arrows, I guess. Haymitch said to surprise them if we could, but I'm fresh out of ideas. As the girl from 12, I'm scheduled to go last. The dining room gets quieter and quieter as the tributes file out to go perform. It's easier to keep up the irreverent, invincible manner we've all adopted when there are more of us. As people disappear through the door, all I can think is that they have a matter of days to live. Peter and I are finally left alone. He reaches across the table and takes my hands. "Decided what to do for the game makers yet?" I shake my head. "I can't really use them for target practice this year, with the force field up and all. Maybe make some fish hooks. What about you?"
"Not a clue. I keep wishing I could bake a cake or something," he says.
"Do some more camouflage," I suggest.
"If the morphlings have left me anything to work with," he says wryly, "they've been glued to that station since training started."
We sit in silence a while, and then I blurt out the thing that's on both our minds. "How are we going to kill these people, Peter?"
"I don't know."
He leans his forehead down on our entwined hands. "I don't want them as allies. Why did Haymitch want us to get to know them?" I say. "It'll make it so much harder than last time, except for Rue, maybe. But I guess I never really could have killed her anyway. She was just too much like Prim." Peter looks up at me, his brow creased in thought. Her death was the most despicable, wasn't it? None of them were very pretty, I say, thinking of Glimmer's and Cato's ends. They call Peter, so I wait by myself. 15 minutes pass, then half an hour. It's close to 40 minutes before I'm called. When I go in, I smell the sharp odor of cleaner and notice that one of the mats has been dragged to the center of the room. The mood is very different from last year's, when the game makers were half drunk and distractedly picking at tidbits from the banquet table. They whisper among themselves, looking somewhat annoyed. What did Peter do? Something to upset them. I feel a pang of worry. That isn't good. I don't want Peter singling himself out as a target for the game maker's anger. That's part of my job, to draw fire away from Peter. But how did he upset them? Because I'd love to do just that and more, to break through the smug veneer of those who use their brains to find amusing ways to kill us, to make them realize that while we're vulnerable to the capital's cruelties, they are as well. Do you have any idea how much I hate you, I think? You, who have given your talents to the games? I try to catch Plutarch Heavensby's eye, but he seems to be intentionally ignoring me, as he has the entire training period. I remember how he sought me out for a dance, how pleased he was to show me the mockingjay on his watch. His friendly manner has no place here. How could it, when I'm a mere tribute and he's the head game-maker, so powerful, so removed, so safe? Suddenly I know just what I'm going to do. Something that will blow anything Peter did right out of the water. I go over to the knot-tying station and get a length of rope. I start to manipulate it, but it's hard because I've never made this actual knot myself. I've only watched Finnick's clever fingers, and they moved so fast. After about 10 minutes, I've come up with a respectable noose. I drag one of the target dummies out into the middle of the room, and using some chinning bars, hang it so it dangles by the neck. Tying its hands behind its back would be a nice touch, but I think I might be running out of time. I hurry over to the camouflage station, where some of the other tributes, undoubtedly the morphlings, have made a colossal mess. But I find a partial container of blood-red berry juice that will serve my needs. The flesh-colored fabric of the dummy's skin makes a good, absorbent canvas. I carefully finger-paint the words on its body, concealing them from view. Then I step away quickly to watch the reaction of the game-makers' faces as they read the name on the dummy. Seneca Crane. Chapter 17. The effect on the game-makers is immediate and satisfying. Several let out small shrieks. Others lose their grips on their wine glasses, which shatter musically against the ground. Two seem to be considering fainting. The look of shock is unanimous. Now I have Plutarch Heavensby's attention. He stares steadily at me as the juice from the peach he crushed in his hand runs through his fingers. Finally, he clears his throat and says, "You may go now, Miss Everdeen." I give a respectful nod and turn to go. But at the last moment, I can't resist tossing the container of berry juice over my shoulder. I can hear the contents splatter against the dummy while a couple more wine glasses break. As the elevator doors close before me, I see no one has moved. That surprised them, I think. It was rash and dangerous, and no doubt I will pay for it 10 times over. But for the moment, I feel something close to elation, and I let myself savor it. I want to find Haymitch immediately and tell him about my session, but no one's around. I guess they're getting ready for dinner, and I decide to go take a shower myself, since my hands are stained from the juice. As I stand in the water, I begin to wonder about the wisdom of my latest trick. The question that should now always be my guide is, will this help Peter stay alive? Indirectly, this might not. What happens in training is highly secretive, so there's no point in taking action against me when no one will know what my transgression was. In fact, last year I was rewarded for my brashness. This is a different sort of crime, though. If the game makers are angry with me and decide to punish me in the arena, Peter could get caught up in the attack as well. Maybe it was too impulsive. Still, I can't say I'm sorry I did it. As we all gather for dinner, I notice Peter's hands are faintly stained with a variety of colors, even though his hair is still damp from bathing. He must have done some sort of camouflage after all. Once the soup is served, Haymitch gets right to the issue on everyone's mind.
All right, so how did your private sessions go?
I exchange a look with Peter. Somehow, I'm not that eager to put what I did into words. In the calm of the dining room, it seems very extreme. You first, I say to him. It must have been really special. I had to wait 40 minutes to go in. Peter seems to be stuck with the same reluctance I'm experiencing.
Well, I did the camouflage thing, like you suggested, Katniss.
He hesitates. Not exactly camouflage. I mean, I used the dyes.
To do what? Asks Portia.
I think of how ruffled the game makers were when I entered the gym for my session. The smell of cleaners, the mat pulled over that spot in the center of the gym. Was it to conceal something they were unable to wash away?
You painted something, didn't you? A picture.
Did you see it? Peter asks.
No, but they'd made a real point of covering it up, I say.
Well, that would be standard. They can't let one tribute know what another did, says Effie, unconcerned. What did you paint, Peter?
She looks a little misty.
Was it a picture of Katniss?
Why would he paint a picture of me, Effie? I ask, somehow annoyed.
To show he's going to do everything he can to defend you. That's what everyone in the capital's expecting anyway. Didn't he volunteer to go in with you?
Effie says, as if it's the most obvious thing in the world. Actually, I painted a picture of Rue, Peter says. How she looked after Katniss had covered her in flowers. There's a long pause at the table while everyone absorbs this.
And what exactly were you trying to accomplish?
Haymitch asks, in a very measured voice.
I'm not sure. I just wanted to hold them accountable, if only for a moment, says Peter,
for killing that little girl.
This is dreadful.
Effie sounds like she's about to cry.
That sort of thinking, it's forbidden, Peter. Absolutely. You'll only bring down more trouble on yourself and Katniss. I have to agree with Effie on this one, says Haymitch.
Portia and Cinna remain silent, but their faces are very serious. Of course, they're right, but even though it worries me, I think what he did was amazing. I guess this is a bad time to mention I hung a dummy and painted Seneca Crane's name on it, I say. This has the desired effect. After a moment of disbelief, all the disapproval in the room hits me like a ton of bricks.
You hung Seneca Crane? Says Cinna.
Yes, I was showing off my new knot-tying skills, and he somehow ended up at the end of the noose, I say.
Oh, Katniss, says Effie in a hushed voice. How do you even know about that?
Is it a secret? President Snow didn't act like it was. In fact, he seemed eager for me to know, I say.
Effie leaves the table with her napkin pressed to her face. Now I've upset Effie. I should have lied and said I shot some arrows.
You'd have thought we planned it, says Peter, giving me just a hint of a smile.
Didn't you? Asks Portia. Her fingers press her eyelids closed as if she's warding off a very bright light.
No,
I say, looking at Peter with a new sense of appreciation. Neither of us even knew what we were going to do before we went in.
And Haymitch, says Peter, we decided we don't want any other allies in the arena.
Good. Then I won't be responsible for you killing off any of my friends with your stupidity, he says.
That's just what we were thinking, I tell him. We finish the meal in silence, but when we rise to go into the sitting room, Cinna puts his arm around me and gives me a squeeze.
Come on, and let's go get those training scores.
We gather around the television set, and a red-eyed Effie rejoins us. The tributes' faces come up, district by district, and their scores flash under their pictures. 1 through 12. Predictably high scores for Kashmir, Gloss, Brutus, Inabaria, and Finnick. Low to medium for the rest.
Have they ever given a 0? I ask.
No, but there's a first time for everything, Cinna answers.
And it turns out he's right, because when Peter and I each pull a 12, we make Hunger Games history. No one feels like celebrating, though.
Why did they do that?
I ask.
So that the others will have no choice but to target you, says Haymitch flatly. Go to bed. I can't stand to look at either one of you.
Peter walks me down to my room in silence, but before he can say good night, I wrap my arms around him and rest my head against his chest. His hands slide up my back, and his cheek leans against my hair. I'm sorry if I made things worse, I say.
No worse than I did. Why did you do it, anyway?
He says. I don't know. To show them that I'm more than just a piece in their games, I say. He laughs a little, no doubt remembering the night before the games last year. We were on the roof, neither of us able to sleep. Peter had said something of the sort then, but I hadn't understood what he meant. Now I do.
Me too, he tells me. And I'm not saying I'm not going to try to get you home, I mean. But if I'm perfectly honest about it,
if you're perfectly honest about it, you think President Snow has probably given them direct orders to make sure we die in the arena anyway, I say.
It's crossed my mind, says Peter.
It's crossed my mind, too, repeatedly. But while I know I'll never leave that arena alive, I'm still holding on to the hope that Peter will. After all, he didn't pull out those berries, I did. No one has ever doubted that Peter's defiance was motivated by love. So maybe President Snow will prefer keeping him alive, crushed and heartbroken, as a living warning to others.
But even if that happens, everyone will know we've gone out fighting, right?
Peter asks. Everyone will, I reply. And for the first time, I distance myself from the personal tragedy that has consumed me since they announced the Quell. I remember the old man they shot in District 11, and Bonnie and Twill, and the rumored uprisings. Yes, everyone in the districts will be watching me to see how I handle this death sentence, this final act of President Snow's dominance. They will be looking for some sign that their battles have not been in vain. If I can make it clear that I'm still defying the Capitol right up to the end, the Capitol will have killed me, but not my spirit. What better way to give hope to the rebels? The beauty of this idea is that my decision to keep Peter alive at the expense of my own life is itself an act of defiance. A refusal to play the Hunger Games by the Capitol's rules.
My private agenda dovetails completely with my public one. And if I really could save Peter, in terms of a revolution, this would be ideal, because I will be more valuable dead. They can turn me into some kind of martyr for the cause, and paint my face on banners, and it will do more to rally people than anything I could do if I was living. But Peter would be more valuable alive and tragic, because he will be able to turn his pain into words that will transform people. Peter would lose it if he knew I was thinking any of this, so I only say, so what should we do with our last few days? I just want to spend every possible minute of the rest of my life with you, Peter replies. Come on, then, I say, pulling him into my room. It feels like such a luxury, sleeping with Peter again. I didn't realize until now how starved I've been for human closeness, for the feel of him beside me in the darkness. I wish I hadn't wasted the last couple of nights shutting him out. I sink down into sleep, enveloped in his warmth, and when I open my eyes again, daylight streaming through the windows. No nightmares, he says. No nightmares, I confirm. You? None. I'd forgotten what a real night's sleep feels like, he says. We lie there for a while, in no rush to begin the day. Tomorrow night will be the televised interview, so today Effie and Hamet should be coaching us. More high heels and sarcastic comments, I think. But then the red-headed Avox girl comes in with a note from Effie, saying that, given our recent tour, both she and Hamet have agreed we can handle ourselves adequately in public. The coaching sessions have been cancelled. Really? Says Peter, taking the note from my hand and examining it. Do you know what this means? We'll have the whole day to ourselves. It's too bad we can't go somewhere, I say wistfully. Who says we can't? He asks. The roof. We order a bunch of food, grab some blankets, and head up to the roof for a picnic. A day-long picnic in the flower garden that tinkles with wind chimes. We eat, we lie in the sun, I snap off hanging vines and use my newfound knowledge from training to practice knots and weave nets. Peter sketches me. We make up a game with the force field that surrounds the roof. One of us throws an apple into it, and the other person has to catch it. No one bothers us. By late afternoon, I lie with my head on Peter's lap, making a crown of flowers, while he fiddles with my hair, claiming he's practicing his knots. After a while, his hands go still. What? I ask. I wish I could freeze this moment, right here, right now, and live in it forever, he says. Usually this sort of comment, the kind that hints of his undying love for me, makes me feel guilty and awful. But I feel so warm and relaxed, and beyond worrying about a future I'll never have, I just let the word slip out. Okay. I can hear the smile in his voice. Then you'll allow it? I'll allow it, I say. His fingers go back to my hair and I doze off, but he rouses me to see the sunset. It's a spectacular yellow and orange blaze behind the skyline of the capital. I didn't think you'd want to miss it, he says. Thanks, I say, because I can count on my fingers the number of sunsets I have left, and I don't want to miss any of them. We don't go and join the others for dinner, and no one summons us. I'm glad. I'm tired of making everyone around me so miserable, says Peter. Everybody crying, or Hamish. He doesn't need to go on. We stay on the roof until bedtime, and then quietly slip down to my room without encountering anyone. The next morning, we're roused by my prep team. The sight of Peter and me sleeping together is too much for Octavia, because she bursts into tears right away.
You remember what Cinna told us? Venia says fiercely. Octavia nods and goes out sobbing. Peter has to return to his room for prep, and I'm left alone with Venia and Flavius. The usual chatter has been suspended. In fact, there's little talk at all, other than to have me raise my chin or comment on a makeup technique. It's nearly lunch when I feel something dripping on my shoulder and turn to find Flavius, who's snipping away at my hair with silent tears running down his face. Venia gives him a look, and he gently sets the scissors on the table and leaves. Then it's just Venia, whose skin is so pale her tattoos appear to be leaping off it. Almost rigid with determination, she does my hair and nails and makeup, fingers flying swiftly to compensate for her absent teammates. The whole time, she avoids my gaze. It's only when Cinna shows up to approve me and dismiss her that she takes my hands, looks me straight in the eye, and says,
"We would all like you to know what a privilege it has been to make you look your best."
Then she hastens from the room. My prep team, my foolish, shallow, affectionate pets, with their obsessions with feathers and parties, nearly break my heart with their goodbye. It's certain from Venia's last words that we all know I won't be returning. Does the whole world know it, I wonder? I look at Cinna. He knows, certainly. But as he promised, there's no danger of tears from him. So, what am I wearing tonight? I ask, eyeing the garment bag that holds my dress. President Snow put in the dress order himself, says Cinna. He unzips the bag, revealing one of the wedding dresses I wore for the photo shoot. Heavy white silk with a low neckline and tight waist, and sleeves that fall from my wrists to the floor, and pearls, everywhere pearls. Stitched into the dress and in ropes at my throat, and forming the crown for the veil. Even though they announced the quarter quell the night of the photo shoot, people still voted for their favorite dress. And this was the winner. The president says you're to wear it tonight. Our objections were ignored. I rub a bit of the silk between my fingers, trying to figure out President Snow's reasoning. I suppose, since I was the greatest offender, my pain and loss and humiliation should be in the brightest spotlight. This, he thinks, will make that clear. It's so barbaric, the president turning my bridal gown into my shroud, that the blow strikes home, leaving me with a dull ache inside. Well, it'd be a shame to waste such a pretty dress, is all I say. Cinna helps me carefully into the gown. As it settles on my shoulders, they can't help giving a shrug of complaint. Was it always this heavy? I ask. I remember several of the dresses being dense, but this one feels like it weighs a ton. I had to make some slight alterations because of the lighting, says Cinna. I nod, but I can't see what that has to do with anything. He decks me out in the shoes and the pearl jewelry and the veil, touches up my makeup, has me walk. You're ravishing, he says. Now, Katniss, because this bodice is so fitted, I don't want you raising your arms above your head. Well, not until you twirl, anyway. Will I be twirling again? I ask, thinking of my dress last year. I'm sure Caesar will ask you, and if he doesn't, you suggest it yourself. Only, not right away. Save it for your big finale, Cinna instructs me. You give me a signal, so I know when, I say. All right. Any plans for your interview? I know Haymitch left you two to your own devices, he says.
No, this year I'm just winging it. The funny thing is, I'm not nervous at all.
And I'm not. However much President Snow may hate me, this capital audience is mine.
We meet up with Effie, Haymitch, Portia, and Peter at the elevator. Peter's in an elegant tuxedo and white gloves, the sort of thing grooms wear to get married in here in the capital. Back home, everything is so much simpler. A woman usually rents a white dress that's been worn hundreds of times. The man wears something clean that's not mining clothes. They fill out some forms at the Justice Building and are assigned a house. Family and friends gather for a meal or a bit of cake, if it can be afforded. Even if it can't, there's always a traditional song we sing as the new couple crosses the threshold of their home. And we have our own little ceremony, where they make their first fire, toast a bit of bread, and share it. Maybe it's old-fashioned, but no one really feels married in District 12 until after the toasting. The other tributes have already gathered off stage and are talking softly, but when Peter and I arrive, they fall silent. I realize everyone's staring daggers at my wedding dress. Are they jealous of its beauty, the power it might have to manipulate the crowd? Finally, Finnick says,
"I can't believe Cinna put you in that thing."
"He didn't have any choice. President Snow made him," I say, somewhat defensively. I won't let anyone criticize Cinna. Kashmir tosses her flowing blonde curls back and spits out,
"Well, you look ridiculous."
She grabs her brother's hand and pulls him into place to lead our procession onto the stage. The other tributes begin to line up as well. I'm confused because, while they all are angry, some are giving us sympathetic pats on the shoulder, and Joanna Mason actually stops to straighten my pearl necklace. "Make him pay for it, okay?" she says. I nod, but I don't know what she means. Not until we're all sitting out on stage and Caesar Flickerman, hair and face highlighted in lavender this year, has done his opening spiel and the tributes begin their interviews. This is the first time I realize the depth of betrayal felt among the victors and the rage that accompanies it. But they are so smart, so wonderfully smart about how they play it, because it all comes back to reflect on the government and President Snow in particular. Not everyone. There are the old throwbacks, like Brutus and Ina Baria, who are just here for another games, and those too baffled or drugged or lost to join in on the attack. But there are enough victors who still have the wits and the nerve to come out fighting. Kashmir starts the ball rolling with a speech about how she just can't stop crying when she thinks of how much the people in the capital must be suffering because they will lose us. Gloss recalls the kindness shown here to him and his sister. Beatty questions the legality of the quell in his nervous, twitchy way, wondering if it's been fully examined by experts of late. Finnick recites a poem he wrote to his one true love in the capital, and about 100 people faint because they're sure he means them. By the time Joanna Mason gets up, she's asking if something can't be done about the situation. Surely the creators of the Quarter Quell never anticipated such love forming between the victors and the capital. No one could be so cruel as to sever such a deep bond. Cedar quietly ruminates about how, back in District 11, everyone assumes President Snow is all-powerful. So if he's all-powerful, why doesn't he change the quell? And Chaff, who comes right on her heels, insists the president could change the quell if he wanted to, but he must not think it matters much to anyone. By the time I'm introduced, the audience is an absolute wreck. People have been weeping and collapsing and even calling for change. The sight of me in my white silk bridal gown practically causes a riot.
No more me. No more star-crossed lovers living happily ever after. No more wedding. I can see even Caesar's professionalism showing some cracks as he tries to quiet them so I can speak. But my 3 minutes are ticking quickly away. Finally, there's a lull, and he gets out.
So, Katniss, obviously, this is a very emotional night for everyone. Is there anything you'd like to say?
My voice trembles as I speak.
Only that I'm so sorry you won't get to be at my wedding. But I'm glad you at least get to see me in my dress. Isn't it just the most beautiful thing?
I don't have to look at Cinna for a signal. I know this is the right time. I begin to twirl slowly, raising the sleeves of my heavy gown above my head. When I hear the screams of the crowd, I think it's because I must look stunning. Then I notice something is rising up around me. Smoke from fire. Not the flickery stuff I wore last year in the chariot, but something much more real that devours my dress. I begin to panic as the smoke thickens. Charred bits of black silk swirl into the air, and pearls clatter to the stage. Somehow I'm afraid to stop because my flesh doesn't seem to be burning, and I know Cinna must be behind whatever is happening. So I keep spinning and spinning. For a split second I'm gasping, completely engulfed in the strange flames. Then, all at once, the fire is gone. I slowly come to a stop, wondering if I'm naked and why Cinna has arranged to burn away my wedding dress. But I'm not naked. I'm in a dress of the exact design of my wedding dress, only it's the color of coal and made of tiny feathers. Wonderingly, I lift my long, flowing sleeves into the air, and that's when I see myself on the television screen. Clothed in black, except for the white patches on my sleeves. Or, should I say, my wings. Because Cinna has turned me into a mockingjay.
Chapter 18. I'm still smoldering a little, so it's with a tentative hand that Caesar reaches out to touch my headpiece. The white has burned away, leaving a smooth, fitted veil of black that drapes into the neckline of the dress in the back.
"Feathers," says Caesar. "You're like a bird."
"A mockingjay, I think," I say, giving my wings a small flap. "It's the bird on the pin I wear as a token." A shadow of recognition flickers across Caesar's face, and I can tell he knows that the mockingjay isn't just my token, that it's come to symbolize so much more, that what will be seen as a flashy costume change in the capital is resonating in an entirely different way throughout the districts. But he makes the best of it.
"Well, hats off to your stylist. I don't think anyone can argue that that's not the most spectacular thing we've ever seen in an interview. Cinna, I think you better take a bow."
Caesar gestures for Cinna to rise. He does, and makes a small, gracious bow. And suddenly I am so afraid for him. What has he done? Something terribly dangerous, an act of rebellion in itself. And he's done it for me. I remember his words.
"Don't worry. I always channel my emotions into my work. That way, I don't hurt anyone but myself."
And I'm afraid he has hurt himself beyond repair. The significance of my fiery transformation will not be lost on President Snow. The audience, who's been stunned into silence, breaks into wild applause. I can barely hear the buzzer that indicates that my 3 minutes are up. Caesar thanks me, and I go back to my seat, my dress now feeling lighter than air. As I pass Peeta, who's headed for his interview, he doesn't meet my eyes. I take my seat carefully, but aside from the puffs of smoke here and there, I seem unharmed, so I turn my attention to him. Caesar and Peeta have been a natural team since they first appeared together a year ago. Their easy give-and-take, comic timing, and ability to segue into heart-wrenching moments, like Peeta's confession of love for me, have made them a huge success with the audience. They effortlessly open with a few jokes about fires and feathers and overcooking poultry. But anyone can see that Peeta is preoccupied, so Caesar directs the conversation right into the subject that's on everyone's minds.
So, Peeta, what was it like when, after all you've been through, you found out about the Quell?
Asks Caesar. I was in shock. I mean, one minute I'm seeing Katniss looking so beautiful in all these wedding gowns, and the next... Peeta trails off.
You realized there was never going to be a wedding?
Asks Caesar gently. Peeta pauses for a long moment, as if deciding something. He looks out at the spellbound audience, then at the floor, then finally up at Caesar.
Caesar, do you think all our friends here can keep a secret?
An uncomfortable laugh emanates from the audience. What can he mean?
Keep a secret from who? Our whole world is watching. I feel quite certain of it, says Caesar.
We're already married, says Peeta quietly. The crowd reacts in astonishment, and I have to bury my face in the folds of my skirt so they can't see my confusion. Where on earth is he going with this?
But how can that be? Asks Caesar.
Oh, it's not an official marriage. We didn't go to the justice building or anything, but we have this marriage ritual in District 12. I don't know what it's like in the other districts, but there's this thing we do, says Peeta, and he briefly describes the toasting.
Were your families there?
Asks Caesar. No, we didn't tell anyone, not even Haymitch. And Katniss's mother would never have approved. But you see, we knew if we were married in the capital, there wouldn't be a toasting, and neither of us really wanted to wait any longer. So one day, we just did it, Peeta says. And to us, we're more married than any piece of paper or big party could make us.
So this was before the Quell, says Caesar.
Of course before the Quell. I'm sure we'd never have done it after we knew, says Peeta, starting to get upset.
But who could have seen it coming?
No one.
We went through the games, we were victors, everyone seemed so thrilled to see us together, and then out of nowhere. I mean, how could we anticipate a thing like that? You couldn't, Peeta.
Caesar puts an arm around his shoulders.
As you say, no one could have.
But I have to confess, I'm glad you two had at least a few months of happiness together.
Enormous applause.
As if encouraged, I look up from my feathers and let the audience see my tragic smile of thanks. The residual smoke from the feathers has made my eyes teary, which adds a very nice touch.
I'm not glad, says Peeta. I wish we had waited until the whole thing was done officially.
This takes even Caesar aback.
Surely even a brief time is better than no time.
Maybe I'd think that too, Caesar, says Peeta bitterly, if it weren't for the baby.
There. He's done it again. Dropped a bomb that wipes out the efforts of every tribute who came before him.
Well, maybe not. Maybe this year he has only lit the fuse on a bomb that the victors themselves have been building, hoping someone would be able to detonate it, perhaps thinking it would be me in my bridal gown, not knowing how much I rely on Cinna's talents, whereas Peeta needs nothing more than his wits. As the bomb explodes, it sends accusations of injustice and barbarism and cruelty flying out in every direction. Even the most capital-loving, games-hungry, blood-thirsty person out there can't ignore, at least for a moment, how horrific the whole thing is. I am pregnant. The audience can't absorb the news right away. It has to strike them and sink in and be confirmed by other voices before they begin to sound like a herd of wounded animals, moaning, shrieking, calling for help. And me? I know my face is projected in a tight close-up on the screen, but I don't make any effort to hide it, because for a moment, even I am working through what Peter has said. Isn't it the thing I dreaded most about the wedding, about the future, the loss of my children to the games? And it could be true now, couldn't it? If I hadn't spent my life building up layers of defenses until I recoil at even the suggestion of marriage or a family. Caesar can't rein in the crowd again. Not even when the buzzer sounds. Peter nods his goodbye and comes back to his seat without any more conversation. I can see Caesar's lips moving, but the place is in total chaos and I can't hear a word. Only the blast of the anthem, cranked up so loud I can feel it vibrating through my bones, lets us know where we stand in the program. I automatically rise, and as I do, I sense Peter reaching out for me. Tears run down his face as I take his hand. How real are the tears? Is this an acknowledgement that he has been stalked by the same fears that I have, that every victor has, every parent in every district in Panem? I look back to the crowd, but the faces of Rue's mother and father swim before my eyes. Their sorrow, their loss. I turn spontaneously to Chaff and offer my hand. I feel my fingers close around the stump that now completes his arm, and hold fast. And then it happens. Up and down the row, the victors begin to join hands. Some right away, like the Morphlings, or Wyrus and Beatty. Others, unsure but caught up in the demands of those around them, like Brutus and Inabaria. By the time the anthem plays its final strains, all 24 of us stand in one unbroken line, in what must be the first public show of unity among the districts since the dark days. You can see the realization of this as the screens begin to pop into blackness. It's too late, though. In the confusion, they didn't cut us off in time. Everyone has seen. There's disorder on the stage now, too, as the lights go out, and we're left to stumble back into the training center. I've lost hold of Chaff, but Peter guides me into an elevator. Finnick and Joanna try to join us, but a harried peacekeeper blocks their way, and we shoot upward alone. The moment we step off the elevator, Peter grips my shoulders. There isn't much time, so tell me, is there anything I have to apologize for? Nothing, I say. It was a big leap to take without my okay, but I'm just as glad I didn't know, didn't have time to second-guess him, to let any guilt over Gale detract from how I really feel about what Peter did, which is empowered. Somewhere very far off is a place called District 12, where my mother and sister and friends will have to deal with the fallout from this night. Just a brief hovercraft ride away is an arena where tomorrow, Peter and I and the other tributes will face our own form of punishment. But even if all of us meet terrible ends, something happened on that stage tonight that can't be undone. We victors staged our own uprising, and maybe, just maybe, the Capitol won't be able to contain this one. We wait for the others to return, but when the elevator opens, only Haymitch appears. It's madness out there. Everyone's been sent home, and they've canceled the recap of the interviews on television. Peter and I hurry to the window and try to make sense of the commotion far below us on the streets. What are they saying? Peter asks. Are they asking the president to stop the games?
I don't think they know themselves what to ask. The whole situation is unprecedented. Even the idea of opposing the Capitol's agenda is a source of confusion for the people here,
says Haymitch.
But there's no way snow would cancel the games. You know that, right?
I do. Of course, he could never back down now. The only option left to him is to strike back, and strike back hard. The others went home? I ask.
They were ordered to. I don't know how much luck they're having getting through the mob, says Haymitch.
Then we'll never see Effie again, says Peter. We didn't see her on the morning of the games last year. You'll give her our thanks. More than that, really, make it special. It's Effie, after all, I say. Tell her how appreciative we are, and how she was the best escort ever, and tell her we send our love. For a while we just stand there in silence, delaying the inevitable. Then Haymitch says it.
I guess this is where we say our goodbyes as well.
Any last words of advice? Peter asks.
Stay alive,
Haymitch says gruffly. That's almost an old joke with us now. He gives us each a quick embrace, and I can tell it's all he can stand.
Go to bed. You need your rest.
I know I should say a whole bunch of things to Haymitch, but I can't think of anything he doesn't already know, really, and my throat is so tight I doubt anything would come out anyway. So, once again, I let Peter speak for us both. You take care, Haymitch, he says. We cross the room, but in the doorway, Haymitch's voice stops us.
Katniss, when you're in the arena, he begins, then he pauses.
He's scowling in a way that makes me sure I've already disappointed him.
What?
I ask defensively.
You just remember who the enemy is, Haymitch tells me. That's all. Now go on, get out of here.
We walk down the hallway. Peter wants to stop by his room to shower off the makeup and meet me in a few minutes, but I won't let him. I'm certain that if a door shuts between us, it will lock and I'll have to spend the night without him. Besides, I have a shower in my room. I refuse to let go of his hand. Do we sleep? I don't know. We spend the night holding each other, in some halfway land between dreams and waking, not talking, both afraid to disturb the other, in the hope that we'll be able to store up a few precious minutes of rest. Cinna and Portia arrive with the dawn, and I know Peter will have to go. Tributes enter the arena alone. He gives me a light kiss.
See you soon, he says.
See you soon, I answer. Cinna, who will help dress me for the games, accompanies me to the roof. I'm about to mount the ladder to the hovercraft when I remember I didn't say goodbye to Portia.
I'll tell her, says Cinna.
The electric current freezes me in place on the ladder until the doctor injects the tracker into my left forearm. Now they will always be able to locate me in the arena. The hovercraft takes off, and I look out the windows until they black out. Cinna keeps pressing me to eat, and when that fails, to drink. I manage to keep sipping water, thinking of the days of dehydration that almost killed me last year, thinking of how I will need my strength to keep Peter alive. When we reach the launch room at the arena, I shower. Cinna braids my hair down my back and helps me dress over simple undergarments. This year's tribute outfit is a fitted blue jumpsuit made of very sheer material that zippers up the front. A 6-inch wide padded belt covered in shiny purple plastic, a pair of nylon shoes with rubber soles. What do you think? I ask, holding the fabric out for Cinna to examine. He frowns as he rubs the thin stuff between his fingers.
I don't know. It will offer little in the way of protection from cold or water.
Sun? I ask, picturing a burning sun over a barren desert.
Possibly, if it's been treated, he says.
Oh, I almost forgot this. He takes my gold Mockingjay pin from his pocket and fixes it to the jumpsuit. My dress was fantastic last night, I say. Fantastic and reckless, but Cinna must know that.
I thought you might like it, he says with a tight smile.
We sit, as we did last year, holding hands until the voice tells me to prepare for the launch. He walks me over to the circular metal plate and zips up the neck of my jumpsuit securely.
Remember, girl on fire, he says, I'm still betting on you.
He kisses my forehead and steps back as the glass cylinder slides down around me. Thank you, I say, although he probably can't hear me. I lift my chin, holding my head high the way he always tells me to, and wait for the plate to rise. But it doesn't. And it still doesn't. I look at Cinna, raising my eyebrows for an explanation. He just gives his head a slight shake, as perplexed as I am. Why are they delaying this? Suddenly the door behind him bursts open, and three peacekeepers spring into the room. Two pin Cinna's arms behind him and cuff him, while the third hits him in the temple with such force he's knocked to his knees. But they keep hitting him with metal-studded gloves, opening gashes on his face and body. I'm screaming my head off, banging on the unyielding glass, trying to reach him. The peacekeepers ignore me completely as they drag Cinna's limp body from the room. All that's left are the smears of blood on the floor. Sickened and terrified, I feel the plate begin to rise. I'm still leaning against the glass when the breeze catches my hair and I force myself to straighten up. Just in time, too, because the glass is retreating and I'm standing free in the arena. Something seems to be wrong with my vision. The ground is too bright and shiny and keeps undulating. I squint down at my feet and see that my metal plate is surrounded by blue waves that lap up over my boots. Slowly, I raise my eyes and take in the water spreading out in every direction. I can only form one clear thought. This is no place for a girl on fire.
Part 3. The Enemy. Chapter 19.
Ladies and gentlemen, let the 75th Hunger Games begin.
The voice of Claudius Templesmith, the Hunger Games announcer, hammers my ears. I have less than a minute to get my bearings. Then the gong will sound and the tributes will be free to move off their metal plates. But move where? I can't think straight. The image of Cinna, beaten and bloody, consumes me. Where is he now? What are they doing to him? Torturing him? Killing him? Turning him into an Avox? Obviously, his assault was staged to unhinge me, the same way Darius's presence in my quarters was. And it has unhinged me. All I want to do is collapse on my metal plate. But I can hardly do that after what I just witnessed. I must be strong. I owe it to Cinna, who risked everything by undermining President Snow and turning my bridal silk into mockingjay plumage. And I owe it to the rebels who, emboldened by Cinna's example, might be fighting to bring down the Capitol at this moment. My refusal to play the games on the Capitol's terms is to be my last act of rebellion, so I grit my teeth and will myself to be a player. Where are you? I can still make no sense of my surroundings. Where are you? I demand an answer from myself, and slowly the world comes into focus. Blue water, pink sky, white-hot sun beating down. All right. There's the cornucopia, the shining gold metal horn, about 40 yards away. At first it appears to be sitting on a circular island, but on closer examination, I see the thin strips of land radiating from the circle like the spokes on a wheel. I think there are 10 to 12, and they seem equidistant from one another. Between the spokes, all is water, water and a pair of tributes. That's it, then. There are 12 spokes,
each with two tributes balanced on metal plates between them. The other tribute in my watery wedge is Old Woof from District 8. He's about as far to my right as the land strip on my left. Beyond the water, wherever you look, a narrow beach, and then dense greenery. I scan the circle of tributes, looking for Peeta, but he must be blocked from my view by the cornucopia. I catch a handful of water as it washes in and smell it. Then I touch the tip of my wet finger to my tongue. As I suspected, it's salt water, just like the waves Peeta and I encountered on our brief tour of the beach in District 4. But at least it seems clean. There are no boats, no ropes, not even a bit of driftwood to cling to. No, there's only one way to get to the cornucopia. When the gong sounds, I don't even hesitate before I dive to my left. It's a longer distance than I'm used to, and navigating the waves takes a little more skill than swimming across my quiet lake at home. But my body seems oddly light, and I cut through the water effortlessly. Maybe it's the salt. I pull myself, dripping, onto the land strip and sprint down the sandy stretch for the cornucopia. I can see no one else converging from my side, although the gold horn blocks a good portion of my view. I don't let the thought of adversaries slow me down, though. I'm thinking like a career now, and the first thing I want is to get my hands on a weapon. Last year, the supplies were spread out quite a distance around the cornucopia, with the most valuable closest to the horn. But this year, the booty seems to be piled at the 20-foot-high mouth. My eyes instantly home in on a golden bow just in arm's reach, and I yank it free. There's someone behind me. I'm alerted by, I don't know, a soft shift of sand, or maybe just a change in the air currents. I pull an arrow from the sheath that's still wedged in the pile and arm my bow as I turn. Finnick, glistening and gorgeous, stands a few yards away with a trident poised to attack. A net dangles from his other hand. He's smiling a little, but the muscles in his upper body are rigid in anticipation.
"You can swim, too," he says. "Where did you learn that in District 12?
"We have a big bathtub," I answer.
"You must," he says. "You like the arena?"
"Not particularly, but you should. They must have built it especially for you," I say with an edge of bitterness. It seems like it anyway, with all the water, when I bet only a handful of the victors can swim. And there was no pool in the training center, no chance to learn. Either you came in here a swimmer, or you'd better be a really fast learner. Even participation in the initial bloodbath depends on being able to cover 20 yards of water. That gives District 4 an enormous advantage. For a moment, we're frozen, sizing each other up. Our weapons, our skill. Then Finnick suddenly grins.
"Lucky thing we're allies, right?"
Sensing a trap, I'm about to let my arrow fly, hoping it finds his heart before the trident impales me, when he shifts his hand, and something on his wrist catches the sunlight. A solid gold bangle patterned with flames. The same one I remember on Haymitch's wrist the morning I began training. I briefly consider that Finnick could have stolen it to trick me, but somehow I know this isn't the case. Haymitch gave it to him, as a signal to me, an order, really, to trust Finnick. I can hear other footsteps approaching. I must decide at once. "Right," I snap, because even though Haymitch is my mentor and trying to keep me alive, this angers me. Why didn't he tell me he'd made this arrangement before? Probably because Peeta and I had ruled out allies. Now Haymitch had chosen one on his own. "Duck!" Finnick commands in such a powerful voice, so different from his usual seductive purr, that I do. His trident goes whizzing over my head, and there's a sickening sound of impact as it finds its target. The man from District 5, the drunk who threw up on the sword-fighting floor, sinks to his knees as Finnick frees the trident from his chest.
"Don't trust one and two,"
Finnick says. There's no time to question this. I work the sheath of arrows free.
Each take one side, I say.
He nods, and I dart around the pile. About 4 spokes apart, Inobara and Gloss are just reaching land. Either they're slow swimmers, or they thought the water might be laced with other dangers, which it might well be. Sometimes it's not good to consider too many scenarios, but now that they're on the sand, they'll be here in a matter of seconds.
Anything useful?
I hear Finnick shout. I quickly scan the pile on my side and find maces, swords, bows and arrows, tridents, knives, spears, axes, metallic objects I have no name for, and nothing else.
Weapons, I call back. Nothing but weapons.
Same here, he confirms. Grab what you want and let's go. I shoot an arrow at Inobaria, who's gotten in too close for comfort, but she's expecting it and dives back into the water before it can find its mark. Gloss isn't quite as swift, and I sink an arrow into his calf as he plunges into the waves. I sling an extra bow and a second sheath of arrows over my body, slide 2 long knives and an awl into my belt, and meet up with Finnick at the front of the pile.
Do something about that, would you?
He says. I see Brutus barreling toward us. His belt is undone, and he has it stretched between his hands as a kind of shield. I shoot at him, and he manages to block the arrow with his belt before it can skewer his liver. Where it punctures the belt, a purple liquid spews forth, coating his face. As I reload, Brutus flattens on the ground, rolls the few feet to the water, and submerges. There's a clang of metal falling behind me.
Let's clear out, I say to Finnick.
This last altercation has given Inobaria and Gloss time to reach the cornucopia. Brutus is within shooting distance, and somewhere, certainly Kashmir, is nearby too. These 4 classic careers will no doubt have a prior alliance. If I had only my own safety to consider, I might be willing to take them on with Finnick by my side, but it's Peter I'm thinking about. I spot him now, still stranded on his metal plate. I take off, and Finnick follows without question, as if knowing this will be my next move. When I'm as close as I can get, I start removing knives from my belt, preparing to swim out to reach him and somehow bring him in. Finnick drops a hand on my shoulder.
I'll get him.
Suspicion flickers up inside me. Could this all just be a ruse? For Finnick to win my trust and then swim out and drown Peter?
I can, I insist. But Finnick has dropped all his weapons to the ground.
Better not exert yourself. Not in your condition,
he says, and reaches down and pats my abdomen. Oh, right. I'm supposed to be pregnant, I think. While I'm trying to think what that means and how I should act, maybe throw up or something, Finnick has positioned himself at the edge of the water.
Cover me, he says.
He disappears with a flawless dive.
I raise my bow, warding off any attackers from the cornucopia, but no one seems interested in pursuing us. Sure enough, Gloss, Kashmir, Inobaria, and Brutus have gathered, their pack formed already, picking over the weapons. A quick survey of the rest of the arena shows that most of the tributes are still trapped on their plates. Wait, no, there's someone standing on the spoke to my left, the one opposite Peter.
It's Mags.
But she neither heads for the cornucopia nor tries to flee. Instead, she splashes into the water and starts paddling toward me, her gray head bobbing above the waves. Well, she's old, but I guess after 80 years of living in District 4, she can keep afloat.
Finnick has reached Peter now and is towing him back, one arm across his chest while the other propels them through the water with easy strokes. Peter rides along without resisting. I don't know what Finnick said or did that convinced him to put his life in his hands, showed him the bangle, maybe. Or just the sight of me waiting might have been enough. When they reach the sand, I help haul Peter up onto dry land.
Hello again, he says, and gives me a kiss. We've got allies.
Yes, just as Haymitch intended, I answer.
Remind me, did we make deals with anyone else? Peeta asks.
Only Mags, I think, I say. I nod toward the old woman doggedly making her way toward us.
Well, I can't leave Mags behind, says Finnick. She's one of the few people who actually likes me.
I've got no problem with Mags, I say, especially now that I see the arena. Her fishhooks are probably our best chance of getting a meal.
Katniss.